Get in on all the sports action and your chance to win up to 100 times your cash with Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match up to $100. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 long seasons of exile in the National League. Dedicated staff and passionate supporters celebrate the city's return to glory, the big time, all while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in that higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One's promised land? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. You're listening to the Men in Blazers Media Network. Suboptimal Radio.
El balón que vino elevado, otro cabezazo, segundo gol de Real Madrid, Karim Benzema. Balón de oro.
Oh, there's few better ways to begin a podcast than by screaming that. This is Rog, and you are listening to European Nights, presented by Paramount Plus, the show that loves football played under the floodlights almost as much as Karim Benzema does. And as ever, I'm joined by the Pep Guardiola to my Diego Simeone, the Riquelme to my Route 1 Argy Bargy, to New York Times chief soccer correspondent, and the man who's Benzema's good luck charm. He loves to score Champions League hat-tricks when you're in the stadium, Rory. What was it like to be there to witness this madness again?
Yeah, and I'm starting to regard myself as Karim Benzema's muse, to be honest. I think that's the way that the evidence points. There's no other conclusion to be reached. It was extraordinary. This one was probably a better hat-trick than the one that he scored against PSG a few weeks ago. The power in the first header, but the artfulness of the second one. The way he took the pace out of the ball and curled it beyond Edouard Mendy. Third one, Mendy presented to him on a plate, which was very nice of him, but similar to Donnarumma. But yeah, that's Karim Benzema. Karim Benzema makes goalkeepers do weird stuff, and that's quite a useful trait to have. He's a brilliant footballer to watch in the flesh. He's an absolute pleasure to watch.
Karim the Dream became just the second player to score hat-tricks in back-to-back knockout games. The other one was that cell phone smasher named Cristiano Ronaldo. Benz has done the impossible and survived the curse of Rog after last episode's deep dive. I will say this, watching Chelsea, the reigning champs of Europe and the world, defenestrated at home by Real Madrid, it was like watching the loudmouth guy in the bar turning around and running square into the chest of the buff bouncer who's seen it all. Pulisic plus 10. We'll have it all to do in Madrid this week. You'll be there at the Bernabeu in person to witness it live. After the final whistle last week, Tuchel, you said the tie was over. It's not though, is it?
No, not at all. I don't think it's that unrealistic to think that Chelsea can beat Real Madrid in Madrid. It's a tall order, obviously, and the Bernabeu is a special place on a Champions League night. But Chelsea, I think, have a higher ceiling than Real Madrid. So if Chelsea play to their best, they should win. The tie's not over. Not a chance. Chelsea are far too good to write themselves off. I can understand why Tuchel said it. I think he was probably feeling emotional, quite annoyed. You don't want to be going into that tie with two goals to make up. But at the same time, this isn't a vintage Real Madrid.
One thing sure, as long as good luck charm Rory Smith is in the building, Real Madrid will have nothing to fear. We're going to talk through the rest of this quarterfinal stage today. Now let's make like Benzema and get to the good stuff. Vamos, Dale Atleti, sung by the Atletico Madrid ultra group El Frente Atletico. And the second verse is amazing. I'll translate just roughly off the top of my head. People say we're drunk, lazy delinquents. I don't pay attention. I go everywhere because I'm one of the Frente, the Atletico front, and I can't be controlled. I love that last line. And we have to start here, Rory, with the uncontrollable Atleti hosting Manchester City. Second leg will be played in Madrid, kicking off Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Paramount Plus. You will be in person at that one too. Sometimes, Rory, a lot of the time, all the time, I envy your life. Atleti trail 1-0 after Phil Foden, that impact substitute, nicknamed Pep's lad by the rest of his team, slipped in Kevin De Bruyne in the 70th minute in Manchester. And this clash, I'm really fascinated by the philosophical differences between Pep Guardiola and Diego Simeone, the two coaches who, when they clash, feels like they'd seen in Heat between De Niro and Pacino. Just epic. There's a flip side to that coin. What if you do got me boxed in and I gotta put you down? Because no matter what, you will not get in my way. Pep, the obsessive, driven by a fundamental belief, football is a game to be won with control, to avant-garde creativity, dominant possession and origami-esque passing. And Simeone, that dark knight black hat who believes the battle will be won by the team willing to strangle, smother, batter and negate, the squad willing to suffer more. And last week in Manchester, these two contrasting men stood side by side in the coaching area in nearly identical black puffer-coated outfits to brave the rain falling hard on that humdrum town. And we saw the first leg. Their philosophically irreconcilable styles pushed each other to extremes. You can just pluck any statistic at random. 71% possession for City, 400 more passes completed, 24 crosses attempted to 4. And I think the only shots Atleti managed to get on target, they were delivered to Jack Grealish's down belows. And when it came to testing Edison, they put exactly zero bloody shots on goal. And before we look at this clash more fundamentally in terms of ideologies coming head to head, can you give us a sense, Rory? You were there. What was it like to watch a Guardiola team and a Simeone team clash, battle of the bastards style?
I think the answer that I'm meant to give is probably always a fascinating tactical encounter. That it was really, you know, it was brilliant, compelling viewing to see these two sort of deeply entrenched opposing forces meet each other. But to be honest, it was just quite dull. it was a very strange, for a Champions League quarterfinal, and Man City's fans have a slightly strange relationship with the Champions League. They don't like UEFA. I think the competition has hurt them before and they kind of expect it to hurt them again. They're not up for Champions League games in the way that they were up for, say, the meeting with Liverpool on Sunday. That the atmosphere there was a world apart. But part of it is to do with Atletico. Atletico are there to make sure you do not have a nice time. Atletico do not want you to enjoy the spectacle. Atletico do not want there to be a spectacle. They want you to go home and maybe think, do you know what, I can't really be bothered with football anymore. It doesn't really appeal to me. I'm not sure I actually like it. They want you to see it for what it is, which is a leisure activity that we all devote a lot of time to. Their chief weapon is ennui, essentially. They want you to feel some sort of deep self-loathing, irrevocable boredom with the whole enterprise. And they do it admirably. It's not necessarily great viewing. It's not necessarily great entertainment. It's not meant to be great entertainment. But it's really hard not to be impressed when a team defends with such discipline, with such organization, with such ferocity. Those are all virtues. They're things that we should applaud as much as we applaud silky attacking play and intricate passing maneuvers. Like, that it's fine to be tough and to be rugged and to be grizzled. That those are good things in any sport, and certainly in football. The one quibble I would have had with Atleti's performance last week, to me, I think a truly great defensive performance has to carry an attacking threat. That if you're not causing your opposition some sort of concern, then you are not defending properly. Because it's, if you think about it on the basic level, if there are a couple of moments where you look like you might score a goal, then the opposition have to double check whether they can pour forward at will. They have to second guess themselves. They have to think, if I make this run, then what if we lose the ball and they get in behind me? We have seen they carry a threat. And there was too little of that from Atletico. And that might be to do with City's quality, but it felt a little bit like Simeone had just decided, this is an occasion for pure cholismo. There is no reason to attack at all. You know, if they give us a goal, we'll take it. But we're not going to force the issue. We'll get them back to Madrid. We'll be in the game. And then we'll take them on there. We'll maybe stand up to them. And it just felt a little bit limited, even by Atletico standards.
I'm sold on this model of Atleti as just a better looking Spanish Pete Burnley. I can't wait to tune in. And the thing I am going to tune in for is Pep against Diego Simeone, these two stalwarts of the modern game. And surprisingly, they've only met three times prior to this tie. First, February 2012 at the Vicente Calderon, when an 81st minute Lionel Messi free kick caught out Courtois, then in goal for Atleti. And Diego Simeone, he'd only taken over in Madrid 2 months earlier, and it would be Guardiola's final season at Barcelona, a real sliding doors moment for La Liga at the time. But when they next met in the Champions League semi-final 2016, everyone knew by then what these two managers were all about. This was Pep Guardiola's final season at his club once again. He was then leading Bayern Munich, that Bundesliga powerhouse, but a team who were routinely bounced in the semi-finals of the Champions League each year, agonisingly since his arrival. They'd lost to Real Madrid and Barcelona the 2 years prior, and this was an Atletico Madrid near the heights of their smiting fist powers, that of the war-tested Diego Godin defining their collective graft, and a young, potent Antoine Griezmann leading the charges out of the back. They claimed the first leg at home 1-0, thanks to a dancing Saúl who emerged from a midfield Simeone had packed with four hard runners to disrupt Bayern's rhythm. And the second leg, it was incredible. If you thought that Pep City had pushed the two sides to the extremes last week, you need to go back and rewatch this classic. May 3rd, 2016, Guardiola's Bayern were incredible. The Allianz Arena was rocking. That ball zipped around the breakneck pace as if it were water polo. Yet, Simeone's side held on with just an intense focus and determination. Rory, take us back there. What played out that night? Just how incredible was it to witness?
Well, it's one of the all-time great Champions League knockout ties. It was perfectly poised because Atleti had the 1-0 lead. Bayern hadn't scored in Madrid. So you knew what had to happen at the Allianz, that Bayern had to score twice and not concede, which for a team of Bayern's quality, by no means a problem. That is very much kind of in their wheelhouse. All those attacking stars, Thomas Müller, Robert Lewandowski, they had the greatest coach in the world, Xabi Alonso in midfield. This was a high-class side. And it looked like, basically, for most of the first half, it looked like that would be how it would go.
It's Xabi Alonso who hits it and scores! Bayern a level in the tie! 1-0 on the night!
And you think, OK, we know how this ends. The Atleti have conceded. Once the dam has broken, they won't be able to hold out. Bayern looked like they were just too good. They were that season probably the best team in Europe. They walked to the Bundesliga title. They'd sort of fundamentally broken all form of competition in the Bundesliga. They were unplayable. And then they get a penalty. And you think at that stage, okay, this is done, because Atletico are not set up to concede twice and then have to chase the game. It turns everything on its head. They miss the penalty. Jan Oblak saves from Thomas Müller.
Oh.
10 minutes into the second half.
Oh, Griezmann's in here. Griezmann, Atletico Madrid! They're ahead of the tie again! And that's what they've been waiting for! One mistake, one chance to pounce on the counter, and they took it.
And you think, okay, this now means that Bayern have got to score twice, because obviously these are the days of the away goal, long forgotten, 3 months after it was abolished. The away goal means that Atleti now have an advantage. Bayern need not just one, but two more. They get a second through Lewandowski. And then you have 15 minutes or so to play at the Allianz, this incredible attacking force against the team with no intention of going forward.
Atleti barely touched the ball.
Bayern just passing the ball around them again and again and again, trying to carve out chances. And they did carve out a couple of chances, but whenever they do, Jan Oblak standing there, being generally enormous, repelling everything they can throw at them. And at the final whistle, you have this remarkable scene of Bayern having dominated the game, having played what Pep Guardiola described as one of the best performances of his time at Bayern, being out of the Champions League because Atletico have managed to hold them at bay somehow and squeeze their way through to the final. And it just seemed like the ultimate vindication of everything Simeone stands for, because the line that separates them is really, really thin. Before Simeone took the Atletico job, he went to see Guardiola at Barcelona. I doubt they were close as players, but they would have known each other, and I think Guardiola was always quite open with young coaches similar to him in age, wanting to see how he was working. And they had a chat, and Guardiola kind of outlined all of his principles, and Simeone outlined why all of his principles were wrong and why his were different. And they left kind of convinced that they saw the game in totally different ways. But Guardiola could tell that Simeone had that same obsessive streak, that same drive, that same refusal to back down on the way he saw things. And he said to people that he knew, this son of a bitch is going to be good. We're going to have a problem here because Simeone's going to be a good manager. I think it's not that surprising that Guardiola could see something in Simeone, because ultimately what they see is the same game. They just think it has a different purpose. Guardiola thinks that the idea is to create as much space as possible to make it appear. Simeone thinks that the idea is to make as little space as possible appear for the opposition. He wants to shut spaces down, to constrict everything, to contract the game. But they come basically from a similar place. They've just reached different conclusions.
They see the same thing, but one wants to build it, the other wants to destroy it. And that game, that 2016 loss, after such a spectacular performance, matched only by really a collective clenched fist, that third straight semi-final exit for Pep Guardiola, with who many regarded as the best squad in Europe at a canter in that era, must have hurt Pep. He decamped. He re-emerged at City, where he has soared, but he's still yet to shake that black dog that followed him. The Champions League, the Champions League, the Champions League, 2017, a round of 16 exit on away goals again to an admittedly generationally talented Monaco team of Mbappe, Fabinho, Bernardo Silva. 2018, quarterfinal loss to Liverpool. 2019, quarterfinal loss to Spurs. 2020, quarter-final loss to Lyon. And last year, of course, it slipped from their fingers in the final against Thomas Tuchel's Chelsea. Rory, these failures have really been perceived as an immense stain on Pep's legacy, especially at moneyed City. But his response has consistently been the same. He always praises his team in loss for executing his plan to the letter, claiming that they were undone by single moments, all the while many accuse Pep hysterically of overthinking in these matches, trying too many gambits, too many bait and switches. For example, changing Bayern's system to a back three in the 2015 semi-final against Barcelona, or that off-kilter trapezoidal system that he unfurled against Liverpool in 2018, or the strikerless lineup that he sent out against Chelsea. Decisions born of an intense desire to win the tactical battle for control that looked so good when he put it out in practice but blew up in his face in game. And last week he snapped back at that accusation that he is, quote, a serial overthinker.
Always I overthink, always create new tactics, new ideas, and tomorrow we will see a new one.
Yeah. So you're obviously being, in English we say wry or dry. You think that's an unfair criticism of you then, that you can sometimes overthink?
I overthink a lot.
And is that fair?
Absolutely. That's why I had very good results in Champions League. It would be boring my job if all the time I had to see the same way against opponents. They face different ways to play.
Rory, in your opinion, how fair is this claim? Because tactical fluidity is as much an element of Pep's successes as it is of his failures.
The problem is, what is Guardiola meant to do? Because City don't ever play the same way in two big games in a row. You know, we're in the middle of a period where they play Liverpool in the Premier League and the FA Cup. They will approach both of those games differently. And that is their strength. It's the fact that they can be, you know, philosophically they remain the same. They don't suddenly go long ball. But they will tweak and they will fiddle and they will adapt, depending on the circumstance, to try and surprise the opposition. They do that during the course of games. They change their focus. They change their lines of attack. That is why they are so good. So to expect him to go into a Champions League final or a Champions League quarterfinal without doing something different is to expect him not to be Pep Guardiola. The pattern isn't that he makes changes, it's that the way things have played out, his changes have been wrong. The other thing that I think maybe he doesn't quite realise is that there is a compliment buried in there somewhere of these accusations of overthinking. Most managers don't get to be told they've overthought a game and lost it because they're too clever. Most managers are called idiots and criticised. Only Guardiola overthinks football matches. You never hear Klopp, who's, you know, who gets plenty of praise. You never hear Jurgen Klopp told he's overthought the game. It's just that Liverpool's defensive line didn't work, or their attack misfired, or whatever it might be. Even Thomas Tuchel, who was just as tactically kind of fluid as Guardiola, He's not accused of overthinking things. He's accused of losing the dressing room or not being able to inspire his team or whatever it might be. Only Guardiola gets that. Only Guardiola is allowed to be too clever to win a football match. That is a strange form of respect, but I think it is rooted inherently in respect. And ultimately, the only way he can put an end to it is by winning the Champions League.
I'd say as someone that's seen their team lift, prestigious trophies like the Florida Cup this season, it is the silverware that ultimately matters. But we've got to talk quickly about Diego Simeone. As we mentioned, for the first time in his entire career at Atletico Madrid, his team attempted zero shots over the course of 90 minutes. And what we saw was that in order to neutralise a Pep team whose core programming is to open and find space, Atletico had to surrender almost all attacking threat, footballing unilateral disarmament, in order to devote themselves to closing that space. So on paper, losing only 1-0 was actually a bit of a result going into their home leg. Simeone described the match with his favourite phrase, "We had to suffer." And so did we. You and I spoke in our second episode about the Atleti project and its here and now, struggling to implement a more expansive, a higher chance creating system, an evolved Diego Simeone style of footballing. But at his core, in massive games like this, Diego is more of a scorched earth kind of guy. Rory, do you see any pathway, any hope for this second leg, or will it need to come from City shooting themselves in the foot?
Not quite, but not far off. I'm not sure it's likely that Atletico will suddenly rediscover their kind of Brazil 1970 touch and just go all expansive, tiki-taka, creating loads of chances, pouring forward. I would guess that Simeone's thinking, and you're right, he will have been quite happy with a 1-0 away from home, especially with the away goals rule gone. That's not a bad result. He will believe, certainly, that Atletico can score a goal against Manchester City and can keep them out in Madrid. And that's not beyond the realms of possibility. The difficult bit is getting that balance between shutting City down. The City are a vastly superior technical team to Atletico, no question about that. Shutting them down while simultaneously posing a threat. They got that balance wrong in Manchester. They needed to ask City a few more questions than they did. And they would have had a more effective defensive performance, I think, had they done so. How they do that, I'm not sure. My guess is that Simeone will basically ask them to do more of the same, to say, do you know what? Frustrate them, annoy them. Let's hope Grealish plays so we can really see how much we can wind him up. And then with half an hour to go, when things are a little bit fragile, when things are quite tense, when City know that it only takes a corner, it only takes a free kick, it only takes one mistake, that's when Atletico try and turn the screw a little bit.
I cannot wait to watch this game. 3 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday, a match which really is the pen versus the sword, paper cuts versus sledgehammer. Oh, bring it on. The other Wednesday kickoff, Liverpool, who hold a 3-1 aggregate lead over Benfica going into their home leg. Game plan should be simple. Play Luis Diaz. The former Porto forward has faced Benfica 8 times now and not lost once. Benfica, God bless them, insist on playing a left winger named Everton. Doesn't matter if it's on the front or the back of the shirt, all roads lead to the same place, defeat. And on Tuesday, Unai Emery and Villarreal will defend their 1-0 lead. Astonishing. Over Bayern Munich, they will defend it tooth and nail when they travel to Germany. Over the weekend, Unai rotated his entire starting 11, including even his goalkeeper. He is ready to make history. And of course, as we discussed, Real Madrid host Chelsea. Those two matches kick off at 3 p.m. Eastern time on Paramount Plus. In a minute, we'll roll up our sleeves, get down and dirty in the Europa League after a quick message from Paramount Plus. You know what feels even better than correctly predicting the outcome of a football game? Winning up to 100 times your cash while doing it. Cash in with your soccer knowledge on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. quick withdrawals, easy gameplay, an enormous selection of players and stat types. That's what makes Prize Picks America's number one fantasy sports app. We love easy gameplay here at Men in Blazers. Just love it. Easy gameplay. Prize Picks offers weekly promotions and special offers for the biggest moments of the sports season. Look, for Everton fans, it's not been the easiest campaign, although it hasn't been the worst either yet. But one way to make those Sean Dyche-induced draws more exciting, Prize Picks. Love smashing more on Jordan Pickford saves, less on Michael Keane passes completed, and much, much less on Beto goal contributions. Oh, it allows me to feel good about feeling bad. Download the app today and use code MIB for a first deposit match up to $100. That's promo code MIB. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy. It's Rog here to tell you about a product that I simply adore. It's been a long time staple in the Bennett refrigerator, Stoke cold brew coffee. Always bold, always smooth. Yes, that is the very same Stoke as in the mighty Wrexham fortress known as the Stoke Kairas or the Stoke Racecourse, Wrexham AFC's home. They support it. They support football, which is just one great reason to love this coffee. It is my go-to enjoy during the football calendar, essentially the opposite of Everton. And you can check out their full lineup of 48 ounce cold brew products, some for everybody, from light to dark roast to seasonal favourites in a refrigerated multi-serve format. I tell you this, as someone whose blood type is now officially Stoke Espresso Blend, have the coffee house experience in the comfort of your own home and do it now. Stoke Cold Brew Coffee, and be sure to follow Wrexham AFC. Big love to all at Stoke. Courage. That is Being Barca is the Best There Is, a traditional song heard often around Barcelona and especially in the Camp Nou. But the rendition you just heard, it came straight from the Barca players themselves in their moment of victory in the away locker room at Real Madrid. Xavi's boys celebrating the 4-0 beatdown of their arch rivals just 3 weeks ago. Barcelona are back, baby! Debts refinance, better than ever. Well, maybe not ever, but you know, recency bias. They survived a big test in the first leg at Frankfurt. A neat passing move between Frenkie de Jong and Fran Torres, and in them a 1-1 draw on the road. The second leg kicks off 3 p.m. Eastern on Paramount Plus. The ninth place Bundesliga side travelling to the Camp Nou, a stadium they'd seen a real mood change ever since we last spoke about them in our first episode back in February. Barcelona then were a lumbering fifth. The ink on Xavi's contract was still fresh. And you said,
we don't know how good a manager Xavi is yet. We have no real idea. Barcelona should be really grateful to be in the Europa League. They will look at that and think, we have a fair chance of winning. For Xavi to pick up a trophy in his first 6 months as Barcelona manager, that's priceless. That would be an incredible way of just injecting a bit of positivity into a club that has, certainly from the point of view of the fans, suffered a lot.
Rory, they are favourites now to do just that in the Europa League, and our questions about Xavi have been answered on early evidence. He's a bloody good manager who has Barcelona playing football again in a recognisable Barcelona-y kind of style and has propelled them all the way up to second in La Liga. Rory, big picture, what has Xavi done in the last 2 months at Barca from a footballing perspective?
He's reconnected the club to its identity. He's given it a clear vision of what sort of football Barcelona should be playing. And he's been helped in that. We shouldn't hide by the emergence, the serendipitous emergence of not just Gavi and Pedri, but players like Nico, who've all kind of come through the academy all at the same time and are imbued with that La Masia spirit. I guess this was the bigger test of him as a manager. We knew that he would go in and preach those Barca virtues, but he's incorporated players who are not of that same school really, really cleverly. The prime example being Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who has gone from being an extremely expensive luxury at Arsenal to kind of being a standard bearer for Barcelona. You know, he's not only scored more goals since he joined than any other player in Europe. He's playing brilliantly, and he seems like a leader. You know, he is an experienced player, Aubameyang. He's getting towards the autumn of his career, maybe. And he seems to have taken real responsibility.
he's empowered Ferran Torres. On the other flank, you have the occasional sighting of Adama Traore, who terrifies defenders through his entire presence. And Xavi's taken a lot of those fairly disparate elements of the squad and crafted a really quite cogent whole from them. I don't think they're perfect yet, but you look at them and you think, okay, he's taken a squad that was drifting, that had three or four quite arbitrary additions made to it in January, and all of a sudden he's crafted a team from it. And that is the basic art of management.
Let's talk a little bit more about the heart of Xavi system. Pedro Gonzalez Lopez, a.k.a. Pedri, that 19-year-old midfield jewel who Barcelona just tied down to a contract through 2026 with a $1.6 billion release clause, billion with a B. He is worth it to them. Xavi loves him. He said there are players with different characteristics like De Bruyne or Modric, but not with his talent. He reminds me of Iniesta. If we're talking pure talent, he's the best in the world. I mean, his peak is nowhere in sight, especially now his minutes are being managed a little more carefully by the club after his ludicrous 72-game season last year. But he catches the eye whenever he's on the ball. And what's better is he can now share the burden with La Masia graduate Gavi, with whom he's formed a duo of incredible technical prowess under the careful eye of someone who's been in their shoes in Xavi. Rory, Pedri's arrived so bloody quickly and his mark on this Barca team is so indelible already. It's almost hard to remember a world without him. Take us back. Give us a rundown of where he came from and what he does that makes him so important in this Barcelona.
What's really surprising about Pedri is that he's not really a La Masia product. He's not a homegrown player in the way that Xavi was or in the way that Gavi is now. They signed Pedri from Las Palmas, a team in the Canary Islands, for €5 million. Which is obviously a lot of money to me and you, Rog, but it's not a lot of money to a football team, even Barcelona, even one with debts as high as Barcelona's. It was a remarkable coup. He was the sort of player who everyone had spotted playing for Las Palmas, who were this kind of plucky but very expansive team. They played a really adventurous football, and that allowed Pedri to shine. Barcelona spotted him, they took him, and I think he's probably progressed way beyond even their own expectations. The speed of it, maybe his talent hasn't taken them by surprise, but the speed with which he's been able to settle in, to show it, and to dominate games has been genuinely remarkable. I first saw him in the flesh during the Euros last summer, and it was really striking how much this, I think he was still 18, was dominating games. You know, I was at the semi-final against Italy, and your eye was drawn to him, and that doesn't happen with every player. You can have superb players who don't command you to watch their every movement, but Pedri, you have to watch. You can't not watch him, and it's partly just he's kind of doing everything. There's an all-action element to him that probably undermines the Iniesta parallel just a little bit. He's slightly more industrious than Iniesta. I have to choose my words carefully, because obviously Iniesta's one of the great midfielders of all time. But Pedri is a little bit more box-to-box, maybe, than Iniesta. He's very dynamic, very hard-running, very much a kind of pressing midfielder. But he has this incredible ability to turn. He always seems to have time. He chooses his passes judiciously. He varies his tempo of pass. He plays fast when he needs to play fast, and he can slow things down when he needs to slow it down, which is the sort of skill that normally comes with age rather than a kind of impetuous 18-year-old. There's an incredible maturity to him and a trust, and I always think that's a really important gauge of how good a player's teammates think they are. Do they trust him with the ball? Do they trust the 18-year-old kid in the second biggest game, in the semi-final of a major tournament? Do they trust the 18-year-old kid with the ball? And if they do, if they're all high-caliber Champions League winners, they've all done X amount of things in the game, and they're deferring to an 18-year-old, then you know he's special.
God, I just, the poetry of what you're saying, it's just, my jaw is dropping. You made him sound like a younger Fabian Delph. And God, Barcelona need him, because as an institution, a global institution, Barcelona were rocked to their core by losing Lionel Messi. And you wrote about the club back in October. You said they were a club caught between two worlds, trapped in the no man's land between the comfort of the past and the promise of the future. And all of a sudden, feels like they bridge that gap. Little Xavi in his ripped jeans, God love him. So far, he's not just been a nostalgia hire, but perhaps exactly the manager Barcelona needed to allow the virtues of the club to shine through to a younger generation. And back in February, as I said, you and I talked through the importance of this Europa League campaign. I mean, it sounds oxymoronic, but the importance of this Europa League campaign to Barcelona this season, and it remains true. For this club to get silverware in their hands this early in Xavi's time would be a symbol of things in the Catalan capital, that they are back on track. But Rory, do you have doubts, lingering questions about that Barcelona back line that I'm trying to pedal furiously? Anything that's still lingering?
Well, I think the financial situation is still worrying for Barcelona. They're not out of the woods. You know, they've signed the deal with Spotify, so it's now the Spotify Camp Nou. They apparently, the shirt sponsorship, which will also be Spotify, will five times a season will just be the name of a band and or the name of a track.
Neil Young, five times.
Which, yeah, maybe not Neil Young. Hopefully not Joe Rogan, but you know, they've done that deal, and that will eat away at the debt a little bit. But the debts were so huge that there will still be problems, and there'll still be problems in terms of how much they can pay in wages. I think that there are issues in terms of the centre of defence. That Araujo, I think, is fantastic. He looks like a really sort of modern defender. I have doubts about Eric Garcia. I wonder whether Piqué will be difficult to replace. And I'll be intrigued to see how they deal with players like Busquets and Sergi Roberto, the kind of the cornerstones of the previous generation, as they reach the end. Because, I mean, ideally, this sounds really harsh, and I love Busquets, partly because he is such a master of the dark arts. He wouldn't look out of place in a Simeone team, Busquets, but he's there in the heart of the artistry. What Barcelona could really do with Sergio Busquets deciding he needs a couple of years in MLS, that would really help Barcelona at this stage. So I think that transition isn't completed yet between generations, but there's no question that there is now at Barcelona that you can see the core of what they will be in 3 or 4 years' time, and that will be Pedri and Gavi in midfield, and Ansu Fati and presumably Ferran Torres up front. And that's not a bad start, especially if you have Araujo at the back, and Ter Stegen, who is still one of the greatest goalkeepers on the planet and has another 6-7 years ahead of him. That's a pretty good side to be working with. I've not even mentioned Frenkie de Jong. There is youth, there is promise, there is talent there. You can see where the next great Barcelona side comes from. I don't think it will it's not inevitable that it will emerge, but there are signs of hope, and there weren't signs of hope maybe 6 months ago.
Fear not. Joe Rogan, to me, is proper Chelsea. But that Spotify rotating jersey deal does remind me, was it Atleti who had Columbia Pictures as a sponsor back in like 2003-04 and just would take the field with random movies on the front of their jerseys like Spider-Man or Hellboy. Bring back. I can't wait for like the Blink 182 Barcelona jersey to get into Cirque. The Barcelona Europa League campaign of glory continues Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern on Paramount Plus, along with all of our other Europa League friends. We'll be back to travel one more rung down the ladder of European football to our happy place, the Conference League, Rory.
It's where we want to be.
That slightly eerie military number was Bodo Glimt Forever. Rough translation, forgive my Norwegian. Yes, we love Bodo Glimt, and we love what we see. Bodo Glimt Forever, more. We've dried tears and occasionally fainted. I love that detail. We've only occasionally fainted, but that means we've officially arrived in the Europa Conference League. The best advancement in the world of conferences since Bell Labs unveiled the picture phone at the 1964 New York World's Fair. Now, last week turned up some bangers, some mixed results. The headline, of course, being that Bodo Glimt hit Jose Mourinho with the old Bodo Glimt 1-2 punch. First, a local teenager slash local bloody hero threw a snowball at the special one when he got off the team bus. Got no respect! And then Bodo came back from 1-0 down to grab a famous 2-1 victory, meaning they travel to snowballless Rome, leading on aggregate, and the bad blood of some post-match coach-on-coach shovey-shovey. I love this tournament! Feyenoord and Slavia Praha played out an entertaining 3-3 draw. Marseille eat by 2-1 with a red card against Hauk, thanks to Dimitri Payet's thermonuclear weapon of a right foot. And my pick of last week's matches, Leicester versus PSV, ended in a 0-0 draw. Typical that. Brodge wilting in conference gold prime time. Rory, you've been working on a piece about what this competition has become to this echelon of teams. Can you give us a sense what fascinating and beautiful bugs you found under the stones you've been turning over?
What struck me was speaking to a Feyenoord fan who had, like I think most of Europe, greeted the news of this competition being formed as kind of a joke. And certainly a further sign that European football was becoming overtly stratified, that the Champions League was the preserve of the big five leagues and a handful of teams within those leagues, and that UEFA now basically wanted the Europa League to kind of be for Western Europe in the big nations, and they were giving everybody else this slightly worse, slightly crappy competition to keep them happy. It was like, go away, you know, you can play in this stupid competition. But he's a dedicated sort, so he went to... This shows actually the folly of football fans. He went to Kosovo, to a place called Drita, or to a team called Drita, which was Feyenoord's first game. They started in this competition way back in July last year. And about 200 fans went, despite the fact they weren't allowed to go to the game because of COVID restrictions, but God, they travelled anyway. So they were allowed to travel, but they weren't allowed into the stadium. And they went effectively to try to prove to UEFA that if you stage football matches, people will travel to them, so you should probably let them in. And it worked. And then he went to, I think he's been to Sweden. He went to Germany to play Union Berlin, Slavia Prague in the group stages in the Czech Republic. He had to miss out on the trip to Maccabi Haifa in Israel because I think at that stage Israel was demanding a 2-week quarantine. In the knockout rounds, he went to Serbia where they played Partizan Belgrade. And then, obviously, he is going to Prague this week for the rematch with Slavia Prague. The first leg finished 3-3, which is the mark of a great European tie. And he's back in Prague. And you kind of think, well, this is a guy who thought this competition was stupid, who recognised, as we all did, that this was something that had just been invented out of the ether by UEFA and had absolutely no meaning or history. And yet, they've had a run in it, they've had a go at it, and he is absolutely captivated by it. And it's because, partly because fans like it when their teams can win stuff. That's kind of the point. And it doesn't really matter how much history those tournaments have, because what matters is whether we buy into the tournaments, whether we imbue them with meaning. None of it has any actual meaning unless we think it has meaning. And if you think it has meaning, it has meaning. We can manifest it for ourselves. And the other thing that I think is really important, this can be gauged by the fact that the Kuip was sold out last week for Feyenoord against Slavia Prague. I think Leicester was sold out against PSV Eindhoven. You will have a packed house at Tumba in Salonika, which is where Pauk play and is the best atmosphere in Europe. These places will be packed by people who are desperate to see meaningful knockout European football, whatever the competition is called. And that's because for the last 10, 15, 20 years, with the exception of kind of your occasional Ajax, not only have these teams not had a chance to have a meaningful quarterfinal or a semi-final, a lot of these countries haven't. When was the last time a Greek team made the semi-final of a major European competition? I'm guessing it was Panathinaikos in the Champions League in 1996.
That's exactly what I would have said.
I don't think Ajax or Olympiakos have been that far. Olympiakos might have had a quarterfinal. You know, Ajax made the semis of the Champions League, but that's once in 20 years a Dutch team's done that. These countries have been locked out of the Champions League and to an extent the Europa League. It is only right they have a competition that they can enjoy as well.
Not just locked out as clubs, but you know, as fans, we've all been locked out of football for the lockdown experience. And I think there's a resurgence. That travel experience you've just described for the Feyenoord fan, ultimately, yes, meaning is where we place it, but memories are also wherever we can mine them. And there's a joy to this tournament to watch fans of teams who would be eliminated very quickly in the heavier, weightier tournaments, just seizing every second, not taking anything for granted, and just wobbling across Europe with just a true delirium. And when you see goals like Dimitri Payet's last week, you realise just how bloody wonderful it is to be alive and to be able to watch this stuff. Rory, it's a one more thing you've got your eye on for this week in Europe in action, a game, a player, a concept, a story.
Well, the story that I'm going to pick out, I think, is Rangers. Rangers have already knocked out Borussia Dortmund from the Europa League, which was a famous European night at Ibrox, having beaten them heavily at Signal Iduna Park, which was one of the biggest results in Rangers' sort of modern history. They're up against Braga. They stand a very good chance of getting through after a 1-1 draw in Portugal. They are about to lose the Scottish title to Celtic. They lost the penultimate Old Firm game of the season a couple of weeks ago, 2-1 at Ibrox. Doesn't go down well losing a game in Glasgow. Giovanni Van Bronckhorst took over from Steven Gerrard halfway through the season after Gerrard went to Villa. He did very well at the start, but obviously if you don't win the title in Scotland, you have a problem. But I'm intrigued because I wonder if there might be something extremely unusual about to happen, which is that if Rangers made the Europa League final, whether they won it or not, and Celtic won the Scottish title, it is possible that both sides of Glasgow might be happy. And I'm not sure that's ever happened before. And I'm really intrigued. I'd love to see Rangers win the Europa League just to find out if it is possible that both Rangers and Celtic could be happy in the same season. Because that is kind of against the natural order of things.
Oh,
and it would, in a sense, be a view of the apocalypse. But it could happen this year.
I love that. Let happiness reign. And the world is better when the Scottish Premiership is competitive. And remember, the Old Firm clash between Rangers and Celtic takes place this weekend. What? Sunday. Watch it if you can. Drink it in. I promise you will not be disappointed. My pick for the week, Atalanta versus RB Leipzig. Last week they played out at a nosebleed pace, a 1-1 draw after Atalanta goalkeeper Juan Musso heroically saved the penalty and the rebound, only to see David Zappacosta steer across into his own net some 30 seconds later. Atalanta are on a two-game skid in Serie A, and progression in the Europa League may be their best chance to taste European football next season. Expect hell for leather, or as they say in Italian, Google Translate, Inferno per la pelle. One more thing before we go, Rory Smith. Let's close this podcast, as we always do, by getting your Rory Smith sneaky food reviews. Last week, we talked tapas in Manchester. Tell us this week, we're in Liverpool. Rory Smith, drum roll please, for your favourite eats in my hometown.
Your hometown is spoilt for choice with good places to eat, actually. I'm gonna suggest that we maybe start with brunch at Leaf on Bold Street, which I love.
Yes, Bold Street!
Bold Street is one of the great streets in Britain. And there are, to be fair, several different places you could go to on Bold Street. But let's go to Leaf. But then maybe if we want something a bit heavier, let's go Spanish again. Let's go to Lunya, which is a Catalan deli in Liverpool, which not only has food that you can sit in and eat, but food that you can take home as well and prepare for yourself, which is just living the dream. I think they've now got a branch in Manchester as well. There might be one in Chester, possibly. There's a couple around the northwest of England. It's a little chain, local business. Should always support local businesses. Brilliant food, brilliant tapas, great produce, amazing ham. If there's amazing ham, I'm sold.
I love how hard you sell these. Lunya, I like to imagine when I'm in there, it's where Pep goes to get takeout to bring over to Jurgen Klopp's gaff.
Guardiola does love the Manchester Lunya. That is true. Pep likes Manchester Lunya, yeah.
That is a Yelp review of Yelp reviews, though I'm not sure that Pep would appreciate their Catalan scouse, their signature Liverpool stew made with Catalan chorizo and morcilla. Pep strikes me as a bit of a culinary hardliner, not really a fusion guy. And if you do want real scouse in Liverpool, I recommend, on the same Bold Street that Rory Smith adores, Maggie May's, which we shot a film in for Visit Britain. And God, I yearn to go back. Or a trip to the chippy of my youth, Chris's on Rose Lane, for a chop suey roll and chips. Curry sauce on the side, please. Bite your arm off for chip shop action right now, Rory Smith. Are you a chip shop kind of bloke?
I'm from Yorkshire. What do you think?
Always leave the listeners hanging. That, what are you ordering, by the way?
Haddock and chips. Probably Haddock. The problem with the other side of the country is that you insist on having cod.
Yes.
Fish and chips is with haddock.
God,
everybody knows that. This
is the Diego Simeone versus Pep Guardiola argument brought to the chip shop level, and that will be all from us today. Rory Smith, thank you as ever. We'll return to talk about the semi-finals at the end of the month. Until then, courage, or as they say in Catalonia, coratge. Hey Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.